Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital in cable systems in 29 states, and also, of course, on AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome back to our program. Our quote for the day from Teddy Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt: a vote is like a rifle. Its usefulness depends upon the character of the user. And coming up on today's program, in the third hour of our program, don't miss David Corton, the author of When Corporations Rule the World. He has a new book out, The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community. He's going to drop by and be live with us here in the studio. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. David has written an opus magnum. It's just an absolutely amazing book. To start off our program, though, and our day, Randy Hall's with us. He's a staff writer at CNS News, cnsnews.com, the website Cybercast News Service. And Randy, RU486, looks like the Bush administration is fixing to pull RU486 off the market. Give us an update on what's happening with this.
Actually, the business with 486, there is a bill being considered in Congress, and it's called Hawley's Law because it's referring to Holly Patterson of California. She was an 18-year-old who took RU486 and then died. So they're considering that. The FDA has issued a health warning last July to do that. At this stage of the game, that's pretty much where things are going right now.
So, would it be accurate to characterize this as a full court press by conservatives or by, I'm not even sure I'd use the word conservatives because, you know, Barry Goldwater was in favor of a woman having a right to choose whether or not to have an abortion, by anti-abortion folks to, as, you know, kind of the camel's nose under the tent. I mean, let's get RU486 off the market because that'll reduce the number of abortions that are at least being performed by that pharmaceutical during the first 7 weeks of pregnancy.
Well, I think that there's the folks who are sponsoring that legislation and stuff like that say that there's a question because of several women have passed away after taking the abortion cocktail, whatever it is they refer to it as, that there's possibly a health issue in all of that. And so as a result of that, that's what they're listing as their reason for wanting it to be reexamined since, it was approved on a rather fast track back in the year 2000. And then now there's been some women who have passed away after having used the drug.
Now, RU486 was approved on a fast track back in the year 2000, and it was a relatively fast track because 29 other nations had already legalized it, that it had been used by millions of women all around the world. Randy Hall, every minute, at least one woman dies from complications related to pregnancy. One woman a minute dies somewhere in the world. 529,000 women a year. And in addition to that, for everyone who dies as a consequence of this, another 20 suffer injury, infection, or disease that leaves them scarred for life, approximately 10 million women a year, as a consequence of pregnancy. So here we have one woman a minute dying from pregnancy around the world. You're concerned about Holly, who died from taking RU486. If we should put warnings on RU486 that ends pregnancy, should we tattoo a warning on every man's penis or something?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want that done with me. I definitely think that as far as that's concerned,
the larger issue here, Randy, I'm being facetious. The larger issue is even with the statistics that you guys are citing on RU486, it's more dangerous to carry a baby to term than it is to use RU486 in the first 7 weeks of pregnancy. So why do you object to it?
Well, the objection to, again, it's there's still that danger involved. And as a result of that, you know, those...
But there's the danger involved in carrying a pregnancy to term.
That's
it's
true.
A greater danger, in fact.
Well, you're talking about, though, around the world and medical...
Well, I'm talking about in the United States as well. You look at U.S. statistics, there is a greater danger to a mother of carrying a baby to term than of taking RU486. We still have women in this country who die in childbirth and in pregnancy.
Yeah, we still do have some of that. The honest routine at that is that the condition being that it's going to have to be worked out, and it's going to have to be, the question of the matter is that the folks who legislate these things have seen, you know, that there is a day. I doubt very seriously that Congress is going to pass a law saying then that women should not get pregnant and prevent any woman from dying.
I think this is a phony argument. I think that what you're really trying to do is make all abortion illegal, and this is one step in that direction. By the way, Catholic women have a higher abortion rate than Protestant women, 29% higher than Protestant women. This from a study of 10,000 abortion patients done in the 1990s by the Guttmacher Institute. One in five women having abortions are born again or evangelical Christians, which is a higher percentage of people than there are in the population. Born again and evangelical Christian women are more likely to have abortions than non-born again or evangelical Christian women. This could be a problem for the folks who are the strongest advocates for it.
Well, it doesn't sound like the Pope would be very happy with them. I can say that for it. But as far as the average person who uses 46, again, the vast majority of women never go near an abortion clinic, never ever see one.
It's actually half of all women in America at some point in their lives will have an abortion.
Okay, if they again, according to the statistics that they've been put around, the question again is if you want to look at this from a perspective that there's the people who are promoting this are getting rid of RU486 or saying are attempting to get rid of abortion entirely. You know, I think they could probably work more on a wider scale than simply RU486. It's not. It's also interesting to notice that when the organization that performs the most abortions in the country, Planned Parenthood, is leaning now towards more chemical abortions than surgical abortions, and they're attempting to maintain it through that. So yeah, I guess
less risk. Less risk, less expense. And this again, looking at the Alan Guttmacher Institute's 1994-1995 study of 10,000 abortion patients, and this is a pretty good representative sample, and this is not an organization that has an axe to grind. They said about half of all U.S. women will have an abortion at some point in their lives. Two-thirds of women having abortions intend to have children in the future. 6 in 10 women having abortions experienced a contraceptive failure. 60% of all abortions are the result of contraceptive failure.
You're, of course, aware of Alan Guttmacher Institute's connections to Planned Parenthood, right?
No.
Yes, there are connections between Alan Guttmacher Institute and Planned Parenthood. There's funding and that kind of thing going on in there. So I'm not sure that Guttmacher Institute...
What I'm seeing from their information is that it's a not-for-profit organization for reproductive health research, policy analysis, and public education with offices in New York City and Washington, D.C.
Ah. Well, do a little checking on what connections you find between them and Planned Parenthood. I think you'll be interested.
Okay. So, well, then let's get to the larger issue here. Randy Hall, CNSNews.com. When does life begin?
Now, that's, of course, the major question on all that you're at now. Okay.
Let's consider what the Bible says. Genesis 2:7. And this is, the beginning of when life begins. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Now, historically, the church took the position that people became living beings when they took their first breath. And in fact, the position has been, for a long time, life comes from God. It doesn't come from human conception. To believe that the entry of a sperm into an egg constitutes a human soul is blasphemy. To believe this is to eject God from the mystery of birth and put the power of the male ejaculation into the generative power of God is nothing less than idolatry, elevating the status of mere man.
Well, that's, of course, that's one perspective on it. A lot of folks, on the other hand, say that description of breathing life into a sperm, the talk of the use of the word breath, is more of a figurative term rather than a literal term, and therefore, when that life is, when the cells come together and form that being, that is in itself the act of creation.
Well, in Ezekiel 37, 1 through 6, behold, I will cause breath to enter you, and you shall live. I shall put breath in you, and you shall live. Job 33, 4, the Spirit of God hath made me, and the breath of the Almighty hath given me life. Not, you know, sperm meets egg. Exodus 21, 22, the same thing. And in Hosea 9, 14, God is calling for abortions. You know, he calls for the enemies of the Israeli people to have miscarrying wombs. God's an abortionist in the Bible.
Well, amen.
Okay. Randy, this is, you know, one of those issues that will probably never get resolved. Randy Hall, CNSNews.com. Good talking to you, Randy.
Okay.
Thanks for being with us. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, the verdicts are in. This from 11 News. I don't, you know, it's TV stations, when they put up blogs and websites, they ought to identify what city they're in. This is KHOU. I don't know what city it is. It's a TV station. It's Channel 11. And but in any case, their reporter, Jason Whitley, is blogging live from the courthouse. And so here's the verdict. Jeffrey Skilling, guilty on all counts except counts 42 through 50 of insider trading. He was not guilty on those, but he was guilty of counts 1 and 2 count 1 is conspiracy, guilty. Count 2, securities fraud, guilty. Counts 14, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, et cetera, through 26, securities fraud, guilty. False statements to auditors, guilty. 5 counts. Insider trading, not guilty. 8 or 9 counts, and 1 count, guilty. And then Ken Lay, conspiracy, guilty. Wire fraud, guilty. Securities fraud, guilty. Bank fraud, guilty. False statements to banks, guilty. So that the early news from Channel 11, wherever they are. God bless them for blogging at KHOU. Houston, hey, thank you. Thank you, Tim Tim in New York, or Dan. One of you guys track that thing down, and I appreciate it. So back to our issue at hand here, just to wrap this up. It just boggles my mind when people talk about being pro-life and pro-death penalty, or pro-life and pro-war, or, you know, pro-life and pro-forcing women to carry a child to term, even if it means that it could kill them. And frankly, when they quote the Bible, there's a group called Adult Christianity. It says you don't have to look like a Christian. That's their subtitle. And Miss Poppy Dixon has this website called Abortion Is Not a Sin, in which she goes into the Bible. And as I shared with you, Genesis 2:7, and the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And this idea for a long time that breath, that when people take their first breath, that's when the soul enters the body. I mean, this was the belief of Christians for the majority of Christianity. And Job 33:4 says the same thing. The story of Ezekiel and the dry bones is Ezekiel 37:1-6. Then it gets even more interesting. In Exodus 21, there's the rules of how we're supposed to conduct ourselves, how we're supposed to live. And, of course, the conservatives would say, well, you know, if somebody commits, say, somebody gets in a fight or something and accidentally punches out a woman who's pregnant and she miscarries, he's committed murder, right? I mean, they want to have laws like this, and in some states they do. I mean, you look in California, Lacey Peterson. Well, Exodus 21:22, quoting from the Bible here, when men strive together and hurt a woman with child, In other words, men fighting and a woman gets hurt, so that there is a miscarriage. And yet no harm follows. In other words, the woman isn't harmed other than losing the baby. And yet no harm follows. The one who hurt her shall be fined according to the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. So, okay, doesn't seem like it's, you know, thou shalt not kill, apparently doesn't appear to apply to unborn children, in quotes, or to zygotes. Then in Hosea 9:14, God actually comes out and says, well, this is Hosea saying, give them, O Lord, what will thou give? Give them a miscarrying womb. This is an abortion. And dry breasts. And later he says, yet I will slay even the beloved fruit of their womb. This is God speaking. He's going to commit abortions. Why? Because the people are the enemies of Israel. In this case, God causes abortions. If they're truly innocent children, would God do this? And then what's really interesting is in the Gospel of Luke. You get to the first chapter of Luke, 38th verse. And, you know, the angel comes and tells Mary that she's pregnant with Jesus and basically says, do you want to continue this pregnancy? And Mary says, be it unto me according to thy word. In other words, she gives her assent. She says, okay, I'll do it. Because really, if she said no, or if she wasn't given the choice of having an abortion or not, which was available at that time, abortion is not something that we just figured out how to do. If she hadn't been given a choice, then it would seem like an unwed teenage virgin had been raped by God. And, you know, the Bible doesn't want to characterize it that way. So Mary chose to be the mother of our Savior. God honored her ability to make that choice. So this is just really interesting. There's an adult Christianity website. It's actually over at a website called postfund.com/pfp/blasphemy.html. They note, asserting that human life begins at conception is counter to the claims of the Word of God and is therefore a sin. It is doubly a sin because this debased belief leads others to sin. Those who kill clinic workers, harass clients, and attempt to legislate this wayward belief lead innocent believers down a road to murder and depravity. And then they say, follow the example of Jesus. Let those who want Christ come to you. Do not force the grace of God upon anyone. As Paul says in Galatians 2:21, I do not frustrate the grace of God. If for by righteousness come to the law, then Christ is dead in vain. So, for if righteousness come by the law. Yeah, in other words, it's a variation on by your works you are known. I am so concerned that increasingly the criminalization of this. I remember last year I was doing this show from the Republican National Convention, and they sat down one of these guys, one of these candidates for office in front of me, who had this big no abortion button on his lapel, and I said, okay, a woman who gets an abortion, should she be put to death by lethal execution or hanging? And with a totally straight face, he looked right at me on the air, and he said, it's up to the laws of her state. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. You're in the middle of a vast liberal conspiracy. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, June 12th through the 14th, I will be at the Campaign for America's Future Take Back America 2006 conference in Washington, D.C. Ourfuture.org, the website, will be broadcasting the show live Monday and Tuesday from the conference. So that should be great fun. Looking forward to that. And this afternoon, just as a heads up, I'll be filling in for Randy Rhodes on Air America Radio. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Toll free all across the United States. Pat in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Pat.
Hi, Tom. How are things going for you today?
Just great, but they'll get better, Pat. How about you?
Very good. Doing very well. Concerning the people that want to see abortion outlawed and RU 486 outlawed, I've got a great idea how to handle all this. Why don't we just outlaw childbirth? Women die in childbirth.
Well, that was my point with Randy. Mm-hmm. Actually, what I think, if we're going to have laws about abortion, here's how the law should read. Any person who is a member of the Republican Party or has ever voted in a Republican primary or for any Republican candidate will face up to 5 years in prison if they ever get an abortion or if any member of their family does. But anybody else, no problem. Let the people who are out there saying that abortion should be criminalized, let them be subject to the criminal penalties.
You know, Tom, I really want to take a moment to tell you and your listeners that my husband's own sister died in childbirth. Her and her husband were having problems. He ended up raping her. Her doctor had told her that she should not be pregnant again and that she would die. And she, I guess, didn't believe that that would happen to her. She ended up dying in childbirth. And I'll tell everybody what, in my opinion, what is far sadder than her choosing to abort that pregnancy was seeing, and I'm not making this up, what was far worse is seeing her 2- and 4-year-old children walking around the funeral home crying for their mother.
Yeah.
And I lived that. I saw that.
Yeah. Pat, thank you for the reality check there. I was being flip, obviously, with my
I know.
This is serious stuff.
And it is, and women do die, and people seem to think that that is something of the past, that medicine and everything is advanced, and it doesn't happen anymore, but I assure you and your listeners, it does.
Yeah, well, as I was saying, around the world it happens once a minute, so, yeah.
Yeah, I have never heard any numbers. I wonder how many women in this country do die in childbirth every year.
I don't know. I would like to know, but Pat, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you. Thank you for the time.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing your story with us, too. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen.
Hey, Tom. Thanks. Thank you for doing this, by the way. I learned a whole bunch from you because I'd never known about those Bible verses before.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating?
It is, and thank you.
I put the link to it over on our chat room, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I missed the name of your guest, but
Randy Hall.
What? I beg your pardon?
Randy Hall was his name.
Randy Hall.
Yeah, he had just written a piece over at CNSnews.com saying that Bill Clinton legalized RU486 in 2000, or
mm-hmm.
pushed it through the FDA because he wanted to reduce the number of minorities in the United States.
That
it was some sort of genocidal effort on Clinton's part.
Yeah, I noticed he did the usual thing, too, and there's warfare against Planned Parenthood, and if
yes.
you're associated with Planned Parenthood, you're bad, and I can't understand that.
Well, the reason that I didn't get into it, when Randy said, oh, the Guttmacher Institute is associated with Planned Parenthood, I don't know the details of that association, but the point that he was making, and it's a difficult one to refute, is that Planned Parenthood does provide abortions, and so they do have a dog in that fight, shall I say. And we just have to acknowledge that. That doesn't mean that they're bad or that they're wrong or that their information is incorrect or anything like that. But it does make it more difficult to use Planned Parenthood information against abortion opponents than an independent group. And I thought Guttmacher was, and maybe they are. Maybe they simply their information gets used by Planned Parenthood. I'll have to look into it. But I agree with you. Planned Parenthood's a good organization. I mean, they're saving lives.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Karen.
Uh-huh.
I appreciate it. Matt in El Dorado, California. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Well, I think it's interesting that, some basic points have been forgotten, like that the Roman Church is what put the Old Testament and New Testament together.
You've been watching the Da Vinci Code.
No, I haven't. I don't even like the idea of it because it really is meaningless.
Just don't go to KnightsTemplar.com. You've got to be very careful. Don't go to PrioryofSion.com. Don't do that either.
You know, the people who really think about things when they read something have an analytic mind and mm-hmm. sort of a scientific mind. You can't help but become more like Thomas Jefferson and Tom Paine, who came to the conclusion that you can throw out all the miracles in the Old and New Testament and still get the gist of Jesus Christ, which was forbearance, love, and charity trump everything else.
Yeah. Well,
and so they've totally forgotten this, and they use all this other stuff to justify things like, you can go to war and kill women and children in Iraq or Afghanistan, justify it, because, after all, God justified the destruction of Jericho and all those women and children.
Yes. Yeah.
And so as far as I'm concerned, the God of the Old Testament is just Jewish myth, And that's the reality of it. There's no scientific evidence of it. And there's plenty of scientific evidence
that's
is better than hate.
Yeah, I'll go with you there, Matt, that love is better than hate. In terms of no scientific evidence, I mean, you know, that's what faith is. And just my personal take on this is that I can have scientific disputes or questions or whatever with the Bible, or even consider parts of it metaphor, and still be in awe when I stand out and look at the sky at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, precisely, exactly right.
You know, I can still look at a duck on the river that I live on, you know, just going by and just be amazed.
Well, I believe
amazed,
God's,
you know,
the creator. I'm not saying that I don't believe that, because I can't believe in evolution because I'm a geneticist.
Okay.
And evolution simply is not supported by genetics.
Well, punctuated.
But that's my personal belief. I'm not going to try and prove my point.
Okay.
All I'm saying is keep an open mind, whoever you are out there. Don't believe all the mythology that you've heard all your life, and open up your minds.
Yeah, yeah, it seems like a good plan.
Okay,
thank you.
Well, God bless.
Thanks, and you too, Matt. Thanks, great to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Rebecca in Langley, Washington. Hey, Rebecca.
Am I supposed to turn off my radio?
You should, because you're on the air right now.
So, okay, I can hear that I'm not on the air, but I'll turn off my radio.
Yeah, you'll be on the air in 10 seconds. There's a 10-second delay, so
okay.
If people say something that is illegal on the air, then we can delete it. So,
right.
Anyhow, so what's up?
Okay, is this Tom?
It is. You're on the air.
Okay, great. Well, I was just listening to this guy earlier who I didn't quite catch. He's from some Christian network or something.
Conservative News. It used to be called the Conservative News Service. Now
okay.
It's called Cybercast News Service.
Well, he was talking, you know, in these bleeding heart terms about people who passed away or whatever, and
yeah,
that apparently is the case. But the information that I have is that it's very unusual, and they've linked it to introduction of some kind of bacteria,
yeah,
when this thing was used vaginally, mm-hmm, which isn't being done anymore in this country, and there haven't been any deaths in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as it's given as a pill, or maybe it's two pills or something.
You mean RU486 used to be administered as a, what,
I think
a suppository
the,
or something?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And maybe it was given incorrectly or something.
Yeah, or people's hands were dirty or whatever.
Right,
yeah,
right. That's it. This bacteria was on their hands. And so I think that there have been three deaths or something. It's quite a small number.
But there's at least one woman who has a name that they can attach to a piece of legislation.
Right. Yeah, and then they can link it up with other things like, you know, these predator bills and things,
yeah,
that are named after girls.
Yeah.
And it's really not like that at all. You know, it's a very safe procedure, and probably, I think, from what I gather, safer than...
than childbirth.
Well, than childbirth, or than the DNC type thing that is also quite safe compared to childbirth.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did not appreciate his way of... presenting that, and I get very upset with some of these men who act like they know what it's all about. You,
yeah,
know, it should not be men making laws about it, though there's the women that do too, that probably have never been through what people go through who decide to have an abortion.
Yeah, or
nobody wants to have an abortion, but some people, first of all, need it medically, and in South Dakota where they have passed something that actually hasn't totally gone into effect yet, but they are trying to ban it for any reason. That people, even if their mother's life is in danger, it's like this concepted being, even if it's a being, is somehow more important than a woman who might have five kids or something. It's,
yeah,
just crazy.
Yeah, and it's going to get back to the I mean, abortion's not going to go away. Abortion has been with us forever. So what they're going to do is they're going to drive it underground, and we're going to have a situation. When I was in high school, there was I didn't know her particularly well. I knew who she was. There was a girl in my freshman class, must have been, and one day she just wasn't there anymore. And we learned a few weeks later that she had gotten an infection as a consequence of an illegal abortion. This would have been 1965, I guess, 66, and abortion was illegal, and she died.
Yeah.
You know, that I think most people of my age, most people, you know, in their 50s, remember, if not somebody that they knew, somebody that they knew of, because those stories were uncommon, but not that uncommon.
In the same age group, and I remember those things, you know.
Yeah.
They're just
going to take us back to that, because it's not going to go away. And instead, if they're really concerned about unnecessary abortions, they should be advocating for birth control and for
mm-hmm,
education about,
and by
birth
the way,
control.
That's what Planned Parenthood mostly does.
You're absolutely
they
right.
They counsel people on birth control. They are not in any way making people have abortions.
No, you're
it's
absolutely
one
right.
of the options if people are desperate and have no other recourse.
Yep. Rebecca, I got to run, but thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the Democracy Zone. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, broadcasting from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the Willamette Valley of the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics today, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, latest iPods, latest things, all things Macintosh. Our last caller mentioned, you know, men shouldn't be allowed in this process. For a lot of years, I started in radio back in 68, actually, and did music for 3 years and then did news for 7 years, got out in 78, and then started doing this program 3 years and 2 months ago. And for the first 2.5 years that I was doing this program, my position was men should have no say on abortion, period. They should not, you know, they I'm a man. I cannot get pregnant. I have no idea what it would be like. I've watched it happen. Louise and I have 3 children. I delivered 2 of them. Two of the 3 of them, you know, we had home birth and a midwife birth and one hospital birth. And so I have some sense of it, I suppose, but still, I really have no idea. I mean, I look at what, boy, it's just, and so for a long time, I just said, men should not be allowed to vote on this. Men should not be able to discuss it. It's just not an issue. There are so many men out there who are so trying to take this thing over, and most of them are in the House of Representatives in the Republican Party, that I just reached a point where I'm sorry, I can't. It seemed that was a cop out, and so I felt that I had to speak out on the issue. Jerry in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hi, I wanted to make 2 points. The shortest, RU 46 and birth control and whatnot. I think it's important. I have good luck when I argue with people and I try to make them defend compulsory pregnancy.
Yeah.
It works real well for me. The second point I'd like to make is I think you made a mistake the other day when you said that voting is our only option to get the bums out of office that we don't like.
Well, there's also impeachment.
We can recall them, especially Pat Roberts. If there was a movement to get rid of that guy, I mean, he blocked the investigation into NSA wiretapping and whatnot. Kansas is one of the easiest states to start a recall movement.
It is. The recall of a federal official is done at the state level, is it not?
Your representative, yeah. I've got the information on my blog, if you don't mind hawking it again.
Plug it.
HartmanWatchWatch.blogspot.com, and you can just plug in Roberts on the search button, and it'll come up first thing.
Okay, cool. Or people can drop by our chat room and, you know, just go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It's also right there. Jerry, thanks a lot. Ruth Ann in New Albany, Indiana. Hey, Ruth Ann.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm glad to hear this subject on abortion. It was interesting to me. I read the New York Times Magazine had a cover story a couple of weeks ago, the war against contraception.
And that's really the bottom line here.
That is what
it's really the war against women, if you want to get right down to it.
It is. And you know, some of the fundamental extremists are spreading this hokum, and we have one right across the river here in Louisville, Kentucky, the Reverend Albert Mohler, who is, you know, head of the Southern Baptist Convention, and they're talking about how women or men might perceive their wives as loose women, you know, as harlots if sex is removed from procreation.
See, how it works, Ruth Ann. There is a group of men who can only view who in order to feel secure in the world have to view women as subordinate, and therefore they can only view women as either sexual deviants on the one hand, or right. as in some way, you know, whores or whatever word they want to associate with,
right.
or as victims, essentially
right.
submissive victims. They don't have a spot in their worldview for women as equals.
No, they don't. And that's, you know, this is really not about preventing pregnancy. It's because if they were in favor, if they're against abortion, they would, you would think they would be in favor of contraception,
mm-hmm.
Certainly in marriage. I just don't get it. It's more about sex and power.
No, it's about keeping women in their place.
Keeping women in their place. And there's also a subtext here about homosexuality.
Yes. Well, that's because these guys only perceive women as being capable of being either deviants or victims,
mm-hmm.
then a gay man is sort of a surrogate woman.
Right.
And doesn't fit into the world of being men, and therefore must be a deviant woman, a variation on that. And a gay woman must be either, you know, must be a deviant or a victim. I mean, they're willing to characterize gays as either deviants or victims, but not as equals.
Well, and I hope, you know, American women are smart enough, I hope, to not allow themselves to be defined this way. I mean, it's just, we're past that. This is, you know, 2006.
Well,
but their whole sanctity of life argument just rings hollow when you look around the world and see the suffering, mm-hmm. you know, most acutely by women and children, women who have no access and who have no, you know, not even the right to say no.
Yeah.
And
well,
there's
always going to be that backlash. I mean, there are always going to be paranoid, nervous, fearful men, men who are afraid of women.
Well,
Ruthann, I've got to move along.
I just
have a minute left. Thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. Rick in Grand Rapids. Hey, Rick, last minute. What's up?
Well, I think it's an interesting discussion. I was fascinated by your Bible verses there, and I guess my opinion is that even if God is in favor of abortion, you know, I'm still against it. I personally believe in a God. I think he tolerates too much death and misery. I think we tolerate too much death and misery as humans, and I think some of what you're saying there is a little bit untrue of us pro-life folks. I, for instance, am not against women. I'm not against contraception. I think 10-year-old girls should get birth control pills, if that's the alternative to abortion. I'm simply uncomfortable with aborting fetuses, especially at a late term, because I think there's enough death in the world without, you know, having that, and I do...
Well, I'm uncomfortable with it, too, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to tell somebody that they're going to go to jail if they do it.
No, I didn't say that, but it should be discouraged.
Yeah, well, see, maybe there's a point at which we can all agree on,
sure.
on that, but that's a very different thing from these. I mean, literally, as I said earlier, I had one of these anti-abortion guys sit down across from me, and I said, you know, what do you want to do with women who have had an abortion? You know, how do you want to put them to death since they're murderers in your view? You know, lethal injection or hanging, and he said it's up to the state.
Well,
you know, whatever the laws are in that state against murder, you know, whatever the penalties are. And I'm like, whoa, this guy actually wants women put to death, Brett. I'm sorry, I'm not going to go there. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. By the way, we have a new comment line, for those of you who would like to sound off, but not in live real time. You can call the phone number 503-323-6620. Just give us your take in 30 seconds or less. Remember, your comments and thoughts and opinions may make it on the air, so make it count. 503-323-6620. Another public service from the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And time now. Republicans!
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going?
Hey! Time for our report from Iraq. What's going on in Iraq? The consequence of our chicken hawk war.
Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk. Karl Rove. He didn't serve. Dick Cheney. He didn't serve. Tom DeLay. He didn't serve. And George Bush was AWOL.
Baghdad. A bomb planted beside the building, wounded a building, inside a building, wounded 13 people in central Baghdad. A general in the Ministry of Defense was seriously wounded along with his driver when gunmen opened fire near his house in southwestern Baghdad. Two policemen were seriously wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol in the eastern New Baghdad district. Two policemen were wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol in northeastern Baghdad. Four corpses were found in different districts of Baghdad, police said. The bodies showed signs of torture and had gunshot wounds in their heads. This is so sad. I mean, this has been going on ever since Death Squad John Negroponte went over there. It just immediately started happening about a week after he got there, and just not unlike when he went down to Central America on behalf of Ronald Reagan. Of course, now he's in charge of all security, all police. He's in charge of the FBI. He's in charge of the NSA. He's in charge of the CIA. He's in charge of it all here in the United States. When will the Death Squad start showing up here, or have they already? To Crete. Back to Iraq. Two bombs exploded inside a Sufi religious building on Wednesday, killing the bodyguards, two bodyguards in Tikrit. Mashhada. Gunman shot dead a tribal leader on Wednesday in Mashhada, a town 50 kilometers north of Baghdad. A U.S. soldier was killed when his patrol was attacked by small arms fire and rocket-propelled grenades south of the town of Balad on Tuesday. The U.S. military said on Wednesday. A U.S. Marine was killed in Anbar province, also on Tuesday, when his vehicle hit a roadside bomb, the U.S. military reported on Wednesday. The following, the latest figures for military deaths in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion in March of 2003, in line with the most recent information from the U.S. military. This is from alertnet.org, by the way, the facts box. The fact box. The source is Reuters. United States military casualties, 2,459. Britain, military casualties, 111. Other nations combined, 111. Iraqi military casualties, between 4,800 and 6,300. Iraqi civilian casualties, between 37,848 and 42,216. That from IraqBodyCount.net. The IBC says on its website the figure underestimates the true number of casualties. This, the war brought to you, courtesy of a whole bunch of men who had never served in war. The only guy in the administration who had served in war, Colin Powell, the only one who is saying, no, don't think we want to do this. Don't think we want to do this. This day in history. Yes, in the Wayback Machine here, the history of the Federal Society of Journeymen Cordwainers. May 25th, 1805, the Cordwainers were arrested. The history of the Federal Society of Journeymen Cordwainers is marked by some heady milestones, including their twin distinctions as both the first and the oldest trade union in the United States. This is from the History Channel, historychannel.com. However, on this day in 1805, I think about the 1805, that was just, you know, 15 years more or less, 13 years after the country. After the Constitution was proposed, about a decade after it was ratified. On this day in 1805, members of the Cordwainers were part of an ignoble event that presaged labor's troubles with management over the next two centuries. In the midst of a strike aimed at winning better wages, the shoemakers, Cordwainers were, that was the fancy name for the shoemakers' lobby, union, the shoemakers were confronted by local police. Acting under orders from a local judge, the officers not only stopped the strike, but also arrested a number of the Cordwainers on charges of criminal conspiracy. In particular, the strikers were accused of violating an English common law that barred schemes aimed at forcing wage increases. Yes, it was against the law to do things that might drive up wages. As it turned out, these charges and the subsequent arrests had stemmed from the Cordwainers' employers, who had appealed to the court to intervene in the strike. The event marked the first, though hardly the last time, that employers would turn to the judicial system to try to smash a strike. Now, speaking of strikes and unions, in today's Wall Street Journal, interesting piece by Chris Mayer, and it just, you know, this is the thing that, I guess, impresses me about the Wall Street Journal, although their editorial policies make me cringe, make me crazy. They realize that, you know, it's the publication for the ruling elite, by the ruling elite. And so they're kind of talking to themselves, and so they just lay stuff out. Hey, you know, here's how it is. The organized labor, here's Chris Mayer's article. Organized labor is bracing for a series of legal decisions that could restrict union representation for a significant number of workers, including many nurses, and deal a major setback to the struggling labor movement's efforts in growing areas of the economy, such as health care. Now, here's how this works. Under the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, as amended many times and mostly as interpreted by the National Labor Relations Board, there are all these little nuanced rules, and one of them basically is that people who are in management can't be members of unions. Now, the reason for that is that if the union is sitting around talking about how are they going to negotiate with management, you don't want somebody from management sitting there being a member of your union listening to your conversations. Or, for that matter, having a vote, since unions are democratic institutions and management is not. Corporations are operated like kingdoms. Unions are operated as democracies. So people who are management are not in unions. Well, what is management? Historically, from the early days of the NLRB and the founding of it under Franklin Roosevelt in 1935, the idea was that people who share the interests of the owners and the CEO and the president and, you know, the stockholders, who are truly management, would not be able to join a union and logic would indicate wouldn't want to join a union. But increasingly, one of the ways that Reagan and then Bush and now Shrub, Bush Jr., have attacked organized labor, have attacked unions, is by trying to reduce the number of members that they can have, cutting back on their membership in a fairly straightforward fashion by saying, you know, there's people who have some responsibilities of management. For example, you've got, you know, nurses, and many nurses make decisions about who works when. In fact, a lot of nurses do it in a relatively democratic way, or sometimes it's done by seniority, but decisions are made among nurses to divide up duties, to determine scheduling. Well, the NLRB is preparing to say, in fact, the AFL-CIO says that within the next few months, the NLRB is going to say that any nurse who has any say at all in anybody else's schedule is a manager and therefore must leave the union. And what this is going to do is it's going to decimate the unions that have nurses in them. We're talking tens of thousands of people. And these are not people who actually represent management. These are not nurses who are acting at the behest of, on the behalf of, and in the interests of management ownership. These are nurses who are nurses. I mean, you know, it's just part of what they do. William B. Gould IV, board chairman from 1994 to 1998, this is of the NLRB, during the Clinton years, the professor of law at Stanford now, he said he thought that the current board, this, you know, because Bush has appointed, he had three people, he's appointing two new people, and these two new people are, this is what's going to push it over the top and turn the National Labor Relations Board into an absolute anti-union organization. He said that they're likely to rule in a way that, quote, effectively denies collective bargaining rights for registered nurses who have any kind of assignment responsibilities, end quote. And he says this is going to have a far-reaching impact on workers. Oh, this is John Swinney. He says this will have a far-reaching impact on workers. Beside nurses, he said workers in construction, port shipping, and manufacturing who might have added responsibilities in terms of scheduling also kicked out of the union. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tell me.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, exposing the con in conservative. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones, my favorite American who actually speaks English, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
I speak English as not as a foreign language.
That's right. You speak English as your native language, and you're an American, and I think that's absolutely marvelous.
I do, and I attempt to speak American. I try, but as with so many foreigners, I don't get very far with the language. It's hard to learn.
You do a marvelous job of speaking English. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it's funny, I was walking home here in Portland the other day, and there's a French school, an elementary school, where they teach in, it's a bilingual school.
Yeah.
You know, for kids who want their, people who want their kids to learn French as they're growing up. And on the sign, it said, French and American.
Oh, no.
Yeah. They didn't use the word English did not appear anywhere on the sign. It was French American school.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And I was wondering, is that because they don't consider what we speak here in the United States to be English? In case I know, you know, a lot of people in England or in the UK don't consider it, we speak
right.
American here. Or was it because the French have a traditional antipathy toward the British?
They can't stand us.
And they didn't want to say the word English.
It could be a sneer at either country.
That's right. Somebody's getting slapped. Anyway, what's going on in Washington, D.C.? We've reported on Lay and Skilling. They both got convicted big time, apparently.
Yes, they got convicted big time. There are all kinds of dances taking place around Washington, D.C. by people who have been looking forward to it, mostly actually in the press corps, I have to say.
Now, I'm curious if, you know, Ken Lay was, just before this whole thing went down, Ken Lay was being considered for the position of Secretary of Energy in the Bush administration. He had a desk in the White House, which was his desk. His private jet, or the Enron private jet, the one that was assigned to Ken Lay, was the largest provider of transportation to George W. Bush during the 2000 campaign election year. These two guys were joined at the hip when Bush was governor of Texas. Is any of this going to come back to haunt the Bush administration? And might Ken Lay now, now that he's been convicted, and assuming that his chances of appeal are probably not all that great, might he now be trying to cut a deal in order to reduce the sentence that he's facing? And might that be bad news for Bush and Cheney, for that matter?
I don't see what he's going to implicate them in, because I don't see that they... I don't know, but I don't see that they played any role in the Enron scandal itself, unless he knows something else about them.
Well, there is one thing, and I'm not sure it ties back to Bush Cheney specifically, although it wouldn't surprise me. Certainly ties to Arnold Schwarzenegger and probably the Republican National Committee, and that is that Ken Lay had that meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger just as the California energy crisis was beginning, just before it began. And everybody was like, you know, what's this all about? And there were these rumors that Ken Lay was going to sponsor Schwarzenegger to run for governor, and they were going to use the energy crisis as a thing to destroy Gray Davis's political career. And everybody was poo-pooing it and saying, come on, this is crackpot conspiracy nut stuff. And then the story kind of went away, and then the energy crisis happened, and then Gray Davis left, and now Schwarzenegger is governor.
That's a bit spooky.
Yeah, well, it's public record. I mean, it's in the movie The Smartest Guys in the Room. It's not like it's a secret.
Which is a very powerful film. Recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, and so, you know, I have to believe that Ken Lay knows where a few bodies are buried.
Maybe he will try and cut some kind of a deal, because he's looking at very serious jail time.
Yeah, yeah, and he's not a young guy.
He's not a young guy. He's not the kind of guy who'd do well in prison, even if he gets into some kind of club fed. And yeah. I don't imagine he's going to do hard time.
Yeah, but at his age, pretty much anything more than 10 years is a life sentence in all probability.
Yeah, 10 years is a life sentence, really.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to watch that. What else is going on?
Well, we have Prime Minister Blair of Great Britain arriving later on today. And
a fellow who talks like you do.
He talks like me, yes, he speaks English also, and so we'll be having a large contingent of British rowdy drunken press arriving.
The very finest kind.
And Bush and Blair will be holding a joint press availability at 7:30 Eastern. I don't think it's going to be held on the major networks. It'll be on the cable networks. I don't think it's going to be held on ABC and CBS and NBC. We're told it's a press availability, which is what is being put in writing. We just received the email. But we're also told it's a press conference, but that hasn't been put in writing. Well, the difference is that a press availability has a limited number of questions, but we've been told verbally that we're going to get to ask as many questions as we like.
Well, that's not possible.
I know. So so it'll be very interesting to see if we really do all get to ask the questions that we want to ask.
This might just be a matter of Tony Snow being new at the job and he doesn't know the nuance of the terms.
It could be that, or it could be part of his move to make President Bush more available. You know, President Bush did those sit-down interviews, those sit-down five-minute interviews that were unexpected when he visited Yuma in Arizona last week.
That's true.
So I think he does intend to get him out there. But
are he and Blair going to announce that there is going to be a pull-down of British and U.S. forces in Iraq in advance of the November elections in the United States?
I would say the answer to that would be no. They trying to get any kind of straight answer, certainly out of Tony Snow, and you won't be able to get one out of Blair. Blair is a barrister. He's a lawyer. He's the kind of lawyer that practices in court in the UK. You can't get a straight answer out of him. So we're not going to get a straight answer to that.
Yeah, interesting. He does a great job with Prime Minister's Questions. I wish all Americans had to watch that at least once a month. You know?
Great fun.
Yeah, it is. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Everybody's got to carry you.
And welcome back to the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no passes from the RNC required. Just as easy as tuning in is just as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Welcome back to the program. A few handy Arabic phrases translated to English. Now, I should warn you, this is from the Internet. I don't know if this stuff is gibberish or not. Arabic is one of the languages that I know probably 10 words in, not even that. So I don't know if this is actually Arabic or not. But it's kind of cool. This is, in case you're ever kidnapped by Bush and spirited off to Guantanamo. Akbar Kali Kili Haftir Loftan. Thank you for showing me your marvelous gun. Phrases you may need to know if John Negroponte ever gets a hold of you and you end up being spirited off to a prison inside Afghanistan, for example, where we apparently are running several secret prisons to torture people. Fakhr Gabul Kardan Davad Re Gush Divar. I'm delighted to accept your kind invitation to lie down on the floor with my arms above my head and my legs apart. Or how about this one? So may Fakhir Tamoma Gay Gofte Bande. I agree with everything you have ever said or thought in your life. This is a good one. Otto Arage Devateman Mamos Behate Hast. It is exceptionally kind of you to allow me to travel in the trunk of your car. Fasel El Tampaha Nagedat Mano Goft Aman Chizhea. I can't even finish that one. If you will do me the kindness of not harming my genital appendages, I will gladly reciprocate by betraying my country in public. Oh, here's one. Jirel Japima Mane Vivike Ar Emrake. I will tell you the names and addresses of many American spies traveling as reporters. Or Bali Bali Bali, whatever you say. Here's one. Martiner Germez Alia Gorban. The red blindfold would be lovely, Excellency. My favorite here. Tiku nome baob korele bazorge va krube goyats im bergram. The water-soaked breadcrumbs are delicious, thank you. I must have the recipe. Yeah, so... something you can put in your iPod for when you need it. Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466. Toll free all across the United States. Drop into our live chat room if you'd like by going to tomhartman.com. I've got to tell you this story. We're talking about unions. The Union of Employers at the Employees at the Environmental Protection Agency bringing something out. First, Larry in Seattle, a quick comment on the previous hour. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I don't know if I can follow that Arabic. That was delightful.
It was grim.
But anyway, I'd like to try to tie two things together, if I may. The verdicts today with Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling, and Lay actually got double dose because he was also convicted by a judge of bank fraud on six counts.
Yep.
That could add up to several decades. But that, along with the news that you covered recently about the presidential memorandum that permits intelligence director to authorize telecos to lie without violating securities law.
Well, not just telecos, any company. It was,
exactly.
This is on May 5th. The president issued a, whatever you call it.
They call it a presidential memorandum.
There you go. Thank you.
That
gave John Negroponte, Death Squad John, the authority to behave as if he was the president with regard to the Security and Exchange Commission laws.
Now, if he had done that for Enron prior to them getting into trouble and that information not being available to the investigators, Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling would still be out glad-handing each other and all their buddies, and Ken Lay would be our Secretary of Energy right now.
Good point. Good point. I wonder. It makes you wonder what he's covering up. I suspect that this has to do with something much larger and much broader than just the issue of the telecommunications companies and the National Security Agency.
Also, what bothers me extremely is why don't we see a huge hue and cry from all of the investment bankers around the world? We have been going throughout the world with our various emissaries, business and diplomatic, telling everyone they must obey the rule of law if they are going to be able to get our investment. If we can't do that ourselves, how do we expect anybody to even think about following the rule of law whenever they have any kind of business dealings with us? I mean, we can look at Russia, and they're a very poor example, and that's where we are devolving to, and there will be no rule of law.
No,
how can investment bankers even think to exist in that type of a world?
Yeah, Russia is very quickly moving in the direction of an oligarchy combined with a velvet dictatorship, I suppose you could call it, sort of like the Saudi royal family and the Saudi and the Bin Laden oligarchy. You know, you have a few royal families or rich families or rich corporations that basically own pretty much everything, and then you've got a ruling elite, and they create an alliance between the two. And this is a very stable form of government. I mean, this is the way that Europe was run for the better part of 1,500 years.
And you've talked about going to Colombia and seeing how they live there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the oligarchs in Colombia, the oligarchs in Mexico. I saw it in Mexico City. I've seen it in Peru. It wasn't quite so bad, but it was meet the new boss, same as the old boss. It was the same kind of thing. I've seen it in Bolivia. I was in Bolivia. I was in Argentina when Argentina was right after Argentina melted down. Of course, Argentina has done a fairly good job of recovering from it. But yeah, I'm with you, Larry. Larry,
yeah, but they had to go through all of the desesperados.
Yeah,
Argentina.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It was a very difficult time. Larry, thank you for the call. It was a very difficult time in Argentina. When I was there, it was 2001 was when I was in Argentina, and early 2002, and I was staying with a family, some friends of ours who live in a middle class neighborhood in the capital city, and there were literally along the street in these middle-class neighborhoods, you would literally see people who had put their furniture or their televisions out in front of their house with for sale signs on it, because that's what they had to do in order to get the money to make the house payments or to buy food. People selling off their furniture. And, it was tough times. But hopefully Argentina has turned that corner. But that's, we'll see how it all shakes up. I started to say that's the direction the United States is going in. And I think it is the direction we're going in. I don't think it's our inevitable, where we're inevitably going to end up. But time will tell. Back to the EPA. I had mentioned this story to you. And this is union leaders representing the EPA scientists and other specialists. This from today's Wall Street Journal. Just, very straightforward. John Fialca writing about this in the Wall Street Journal. talking about agency managers and pesticide industry officials are exerting what they refer to as political pressure to allow the continued use of a family of pesticides that might be harmful to children, infants, and fetuses. In a letter to Stephen Johnson, EPA's administrator, the union leader said scientists are being pushed to skip steps in their testing and alleged that the integrity, this is a quote from the scientists, the integrity of the science upon which agency decisions are based has been compromised. Now, this is a union that represents over 9,000 scientists with the, and other employees within the Environmental Protection Agency. And according to the Wall Street Journal, this is an unprecedented and professional rebuke to Mr. Johnson, the administrator, Stephen Johnson, Bush's appointee to be the head of the EPA, who himself, by the way, is a scientist. The agency, notes the Wall Street Journal, the agency had no specific response to the union leader's assertions. Spokesmen for groups representing the pesticide industry didn't immediately return phone calls. The letter said the agency faces an August deadline. Well, here, let me just boil this down for you. 10 years ago, in 1996, Congress passed a bill, a piece of law, legislation called the Food Quality Protection Act, which, I mean, keep in mind, this was before Bush came along. This was during the Clinton administration, so legislation actually was about what it was about. You would think, you know, if a piece of legislation was passed today by the Republicans and it said the Food Quality Protection Act, you would know it was actually the Arsenic and Mercury in Your Food Act. But the Food Quality Protection Act of 1996 required that the EPA do good scientific reviews within the next 10 years. And the deadline is coming up in a couple of months, 2 months from now. They have to have it all done. Good, solid scientific reviews of the dangers of pesticides that were currently in the market. The organophosphates are the main family. These are chemicals that were developed during World War I and World War II, mostly during World War II, as nerve gas. And when they used them on people during World War II, they discovered that all the insects in the area died even faster than the people did. So they thought, okay, maybe in low doses we can use this stuff as an insecticide. And that's where these chemicals came from. Chemicals that, you know, you would recognize the names of. I mean, they're used in agriculture, they're used on gardens, they're used in golf courses, flea collars, pest strips. Well, the EPA has 10 years to settle this, which comes up in 2 months, and they're dancing around it. I'll tell you more about it right after the break. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Looking for a leader to bring our country home. Reunite the red, white, and blue before it turns to stone. Looking for somebody dumb enough to take it on. Clean up the corruption.
Indeed, we could use some leaders. Actually, we have some good ones out there. We just have to get them into higher office. It's a challenge. It's going to take all of us. We are really in this all together, my friends. That's the difference between the conservative worldview and the progressive worldview or the liberal worldview. The liberal worldview is we're all in this together, and the conservative worldview is I got mine. And if I ain't got it, I'm going to get it. And, you know, I just have to say, we're all in this together. And we're all in this pesticide thing together. I mean, this is amazing. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Susan Finney, great article, great bit of reporting here, local reporting in Seattle. Congratulations, Susan. Well done. 8 months ago, she writes, this was in Tuesday's paper, 8 months ago, she writes, 10 Washingtonians volunteered blood, urine, and hair samples to the Washington State Toxics Coalition. Test results are in, and they're not pretty. Susan writes, it wouldn't be kind to say that these 10 are walking toxic waste dumps, but the level of phthalates found in everything from shower curtains to fragrances PBDEs found in flame retardants, mattresses, and furniture. Mercury, pesticides, lead, and other chemicals were high enough to make both scientists and subjects sit up and take notice. Tests were conducted on 8 classifications of chemicals. Almost all tested positive for 6 or 7 of those categories. She goes on to talk about how a surgeon in Seattle, Patricia Dawson, had the dubious honor of having 38 chemicals detected in her chemical profile. Her PBDE levels were near those found to cause reproductive problems in lab animals. Her DDT level was greater than 90% of the U.S. population. So you can imagine there were some people, you know, rather boggled. Dennis Hayes, the founder of Earth Day and the oldest participant at 61 years old, was found to have mercury above a level deemed safe by the EPA. Isn't that ironic? He says, my reaction upon hearing the news was relief and alarm. Relief I'm not planning on having more children, and alarm that I'm likely to be buried in a toxic waste dump. Referring to his own body, I suppose, Dennis Hayes said with a grin. Well, if you don't like that, the Bush administration has even more coming your way. Because, as noted, the union representing the scientists at the EPA, 9,000 scientists and other related employees, are basically saying that the EPA is going to give a pass to these 20 organophosphate and carbamate pesticides, including malathion. These are chemicals that are very profitable for industry and apparently are causing problems for children, infants, and fetuses. Jennifer Sass, this from John Fialka's piece in today's Wall Street Journal. Jennifer Sass, a toxicologist for the Natural Resources Defense Council and other environmental groups, said there is a lot of uncertainty in scientific data about the pesticides, and newer, cleaner alternatives are available. She says, this is old-style chemistry, and these chemicals should have been buried years ago. And so, anyhow, the federal law gave the EPA 10 years to settle this. And they worked on it for a few years during the Bush or during the Clinton administration. And then the Bushies came into office. And now it looks like they're fixing to whitewash this thing. Well, again, as the article, the opening sentence of the article, union leaders representing EPA scientists and other specialists assert that agency managers and pesticide industry officials are exerting political pressure to allow continued use of a family of pesticides that may be harmful to children, infants, and fetuses. Is this really the kind of world that we want to live in? Is this the kind of country that we want to live in? Or is this how we want our country to be run? That, you know, pesticides, harmful to children, no problem. It's profitable to industry. We got ours. It's the conservative way. Right? Make some money. I just don't think it's the kind of country you want to live in. By the way, Denny Hastert wants back his FBI documents. Denny Hastert totally flipped out. House Speaker Dennis Hastert demanded yesterday that the FBI, this is the Associated Press story by Laurie Kelman, that the FBI surrender documents it seized and remove agents involved in the weekend raid of Representative William Jefferson's office. And this is, you boil it down, it's pretty straightforward. Hastert now, apparently the object, according to ABC News, the object of an FBI investigation, Duke Cunningham, you see, once it's settled in his brain, that his body was settled into a federal prison and would be there for a good long time, he started to sing. And, you know, being a good Republican, being part of the K Street Project with Ricky Santorum, being part of the whole culture of Republican culture of corruption with Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay and Bill Frist, and John Boehner and John McCain and the whole bunch of them, he just decided, hey, you know, better to save my skin than, I mean, he's never going to see Denny Hastert loose and free again, so why not throw him over the edge too? So ABC is reporting that the FBI is looking into Hastert. Hastert, in the meantime, is saying, we don't want the FBI visiting any offices here in Washington, D.C. They can't do that. Isn't it ironic that here you had a member of Congress who was actually convicted of a felony and his office was never searched, the good Mr. Cunningham, and yet this other guy gets set up on the sting operation, Jefferson, the Democrat, and he hasn't even been charged with a crime, and they're investigating, they're broke into his office and took his files. Something weird going on in Washington, D.C., and it smells like police state to me. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, there's some good news out there. Theobromine, phenethylamine, and caffeine, contained in chocolate, actually seem to help your brain. This is interesting. Welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Chocolate lovers rejoice. This is from the Daily Telegraph from correspondents in New York. New study hints that eating milk chocolate may boost brain function, presumably dark chocolate as well. Chocolate contains many substances that act as stimulants, says Dr. Brian Rowdenbush from Wheeling Jesuit University in West Virginia. What they did was they gave a bunch of volunteers, basically Dr. Rowdenbush and his colleague, had a group of volunteers consume on four separate occasions 85 grams of milk chocolate, 85 grams of dark chocolate, or 85 grams of carob and nothing, the control condition. After a 15-minute digestive period, participants completed a variety of computer-based neuropsychological tests, basically checking out how's their attention span, how's their reaction time, can they still solve problems, what's their memory like. The results, composite scores for verbal and visual memory were significantly higher for milk chocolate than the other conditions. David, get me a chocolate bar quick.
On my way.
On your way. Consumption of milk and dark chocolate was associated with improved impulse control and reaction time. Previous research has shown some nutrients in food aid in glucose release and increase blood flow, which may augment cognitive performance. That's generally the theory around, for example, some of these herbs like ginkgo biloba. The findings, said Dr. Rowdenbush, provide support for nutrient release via chocolate consumption to enhance cognitive performance. It's kind of the light news for the day, I guess. At least a fine excuse to be chowing down some chocolate. On the other side of the scale, here we have Dick Cheney. The Associated Press reporting that Dick Cheney may be called to testify as a witness in this perjury case against Scooter Libby. Patrick Fitzgerald suggested he would be the logical government witness because he could authenticate notes he jotted on a July 6, 2003 New York Times opinion piece by guess who? Yeah, that guy. No, the other guy. Yeah, that guy. Good old Joe Wilson. And, you know, this is, of course, the infamous senior administration official here, apparently Cheney.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
You know, he's just not really good at finding people, is he?
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. Really, to be honest with you. Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Yeah. So, but. Mixing our villains here, but nonetheless. So Joe Wilson said in the article, these guys are lying to you about this war, and Cheney apparently clipped this article out of the New York Times and wrote on the margin of it something that apparently he does a lot, clips things out of the paper. Bush doesn't read the newspapers, so Cheney has to read twice as much because Bush isn't reading them, so Cheney has to read them for him. And, you know, so we end up with a situation where Cheney's clipping all these newspapers up and writing little notes in the margins and sending them off to Scooter saying, you know, get this guy, find this guy, kill this guy, sick death squad John on this guy, you know, whatever. And Libby has been asserting, Scooter has been saying that the reason why he lied to the grand jury early on when he said that he didn't know anything about outing Valerie Plame and he didn't know anything about a plan to do that. Only the reason he lied to the grand jury was because he forgot. He just forgot. And why did he forget? Because he's such a busy guy. He's just so busy. And he forgot. And that seemed to go over okay for a little while. And then Patrick Fitzgerald found this newspaper article that Dick Cheney had clipped out and written on the margin of it. Words to the effect of, well, here's exactly what he wrote. Have they done this sort of thing before? Send an ambassador to answer a question? Do we ordinarily send people out pro bono to work for us? Or did his wife send him on a junket? Dick Cheney, writing these words on the New York Times op-ed piece by Joe Wilson. So the contention that Patrick Fitzgerald is making here is that if your boss, the Vice President of the United States, hands you a New York Times article with those kinds of notes on it, that's a big deal. And if you then proceed to out the identity of the CIA agent who is referenced in that note in the margin of the New York Times by your boss, the vice president, that's a big deal. Not just a big deal because it's illegal. I mean, it's like, you know, it involves some effort. And these two big deals combined mean that Scooter Libby's assertion that he just forgot. I just forgot. Couldn't be the truth. And so what Fitzgerald has done is he has said in the most recent thing that came out here from the grand jury, it meets on Wednesdays and Fridays, so, you know, perhaps tomorrow there'll be another surprise, who knows. But apparently he has said, or the grand jury has said, or collectively they've said, we can't believe that Scooter Libby actually doesn't have any memory of this, because this was a big deal. This was not a small thing. And the proof of it is that Dick Cheney gave him marching orders. So they'll call Cheney in and Cheney will say, well, yes, I did or no, I didn't or whatever. But, you know, to testify to as to whether or not Scooter Libby thought it was a big deal. Tragically, I mean, this is an investigation that's gone on almost twice as long as the Watergate investigation. Remember that one? And tragically, we're still not talking about who outed Valerie Plame. They're going after Scooter Libby for lying to the grand jury in the first place. This is like, you know, Martha Stewart. It's like she didn't get busted for insider trading. They couldn't convict her of that. They had no evidence. She got busted for lying when she was questioned. And if Scooter Libby hadn't lied to the grand jury, then maybe Dick Cheney would be the guy in trouble. I mean, we still don't know what Scooter Libby was trying to cover up with his lies. Was he trying to cover up his own complicity? Was he trying to cover up something for Dick Cheney? Was he trying to cover up something for George W. Bush? We don't know. But I'll tell you, the Bush administration in choosing Patrick Fitzgerald, you know, here's a guy, lifelong Republican, straight shooter, prosecutor, Chicago. I don't think they realized what they were getting. I think they thought that they were getting a Ken Starr type, you know, a guy who will just do whatever helps the Republicans and makes the Democrats look bad, even if it involves wasting millions of taxpayer dollars. So we'll see how it comes out. By the way, if you're thinking of buying a Hummer, or a Chevy Tahoe, or a GMC Yukon, you know, one of these big gas guzzlers, average 15 miles per gallon. The companies have a deal for you. General Motors says you will never have to pay more than $1.99 a gallon. I'm not kidding you. This is the Chicago Tribune. General Motors Corp. is doing what politicians wish they could do, lower the price of gas to $1.99 a gallon. See, what's happening here? We talked about this on the air the other day, about the whole tax break deal where if you buy a car that weighs more than 6,000 pounds, it's not considered a car, it's considered equipment. And if you have a small business, and there's literally millions of them in America, if you run your income through a corporation, a small corporation, just a one-man corporation, one-woman corporation, one-person corporate, if you run your income through that, that corporation can take a tax deduction. In other words, you can spend money on a car without having to pay taxes on that money. Of up to now $100,000. But that car must weigh 1 pound more than, at least 1 pound more than 6,000 pounds. Sometimes referred to as the Hummer deduction. And that tax incentive drove the sales of all these big vehicles. And now gas prices are going up, and these small businesses that were buying these big vehicles, really just individuals, but they were, you know, they had these rationals. They, well, the kids are safer, and it's, you know, it's nice, and it's kind of cool, and all that kind of stuff. And now they're looking around going, you know, hey, I'm not Fort Knox. Can't afford the gas. And so the auto companies in the United States have this huge inventory, these big vehicles that are just passe. There's no future for them. And they've got to sell off what they've made and what they have in production. So the only way they can do it is to lower the cost of gasoline. It's a tragedy. And it's another example, interestingly, of how, you know, the industry manipulated government to get these tax breaks because they knew that the bigger the vehicle was, the more profitable it was, so that they're selling a lot of big vehicles, and now it's coming back to bite them in the butt. 16 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
And some months ago, we asked Bernie Sanders, what's the most effective way that activists can get involved in the elections coming up? Should they send a check to the DNC? What should they do? And, you know, beyond the whole idea of getting involved locally and actively, he said, find good candidates around the country, highlight them, give people an opportunity to get to their website, send them 10, 20 bucks, 50 bucks, 100 bucks, whatever they can afford, and help them get out there. And so every week on this program, once or twice a week, we're putting on candidates that we've vetted, that we consider to be good candidates out there, good prospects to take back America. Because George and his buddies, they ain't been doing it right. And our candidate for today is Jill Martinez. She's a candidate for Congress in California's Congressional District 24. That includes the cities of Ventura, Thousand Oaks, Simi Valley, Camarillo, Santa Paula, Fillmore, Ojai, San Ynez, Lompoc. I'm probably mispronouncing some of these. I haven't lived there. Am I?
Yes, Lompoc and Buellton.
Thank you. Thank you, Jill.
And Orcutt and Los Alamos.
Great. Jill Martinez. And the website is jillmartinez2006.com. Jill, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. Happy to be here.
Pleased to have you with us. You are running against a 10-term incumbent, Elton. Is it Gallagher?
Gallagher, right.
Somehow I've never heard of this guy.
Well,
he's been around for 20 years in Congress?
Yeah, he's been around for 20 years. A lot of people have not met him in the district. And I actually have been here 13 years, and I must confess I had not met him either.
So
he's not out and around much.
He's a low-profile kind of guy.
Yeah.
And what
was very interesting is that he had decided not to run He announced to all of us here locally that he was not going to run due to medical illness. Mm-hmm. And so we were quite concerned about him. And everybody began to gear up their campaigns. And then 4 days later, he decided he'd get back into the campaign.
Interesting.
So after
you,
Bush,
you wonder if the Bushies went to him and said, "You know, we really need you."
Well, he actually admitted that he did say that Bush and Karl Rove called him, and he decided, along with those calls and a clean bill of health from a different doctor, that he decided to run.
Hmm.
So put us in an uproar here for a while, but we're going forward.
Yeah. Well, good on you. Let's just look at some of the issues here and discuss them, that your positions on these and where you want to go with these. We're talking with Jill Martinez, the candidate for Congress in the California's District 24, Congressional District. Jill Martinez with a Z2006.com, the website. Jill, the Iraq War.
We need to get it out of Iraq. We shouldn't have, you know, we were misled in getting into Iraq, and we need to get out. I'm aware that 79% of the troops there want us out, and 33% of those want us out immediately. So it's a real difficult process, but we need to have a phased withdrawal.
Education.
Education needs to be affordable. I grew up in California. We actually had free education here. Even our colleges were nominal. And now the cost is prohibitive for our population here. It can be $100,000 for a four-year degree. Well, no one can get ahead without an education. We have jobs opened here, and we don't have an educated workforce to even apply for the jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So education is very, very important to us here in California.
And the economy. The economy is... Just today now, there's a headline over on Drudge, I think it is, about how, you know, everything is wonderful.
Oh, it's such a tragedy. I've shared with so many people that, for instance, the debt ceiling was established in 1918. And from 1918 to the beginning of the Bush administration, it had been raised twice. In the Bush administration, it's been raised five times to $9.6 trillion.
Wait a second, from
1918 to the beginning of the Bush administration, the debt ceiling has only been raised twice. In the Bush administration...
Was that during the Reagan administration, by any chance?
You know, it could very well be. I don't know the exact two times it was raised.
I know at least once it was raised during the Reagan administration. I didn't, you know... interesting.
Yeah, and
now five times.
Yeah, in the same day of raising the debt ceiling... for the fifth time, Bush signed into law a $70 billion tax cut. So, I just don't know how you increase debt and reduce revenue. I mean, I just don't know how you can run a country on that.
Yeah, well, you can't, and that's
you
why
can.
They're running our country into the ground.
Exactly.
Jill Martinez, the website, Jill Martinez, MARTINEZ2006.com. Check it out. Jill, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very
and
much.
I wish you the very best in your campaign. Jill Martinez, JillMartinez2006.com. It's 27 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And dump the reds in a pile, boy. Dump the reds in a pile. You'd better wipe off that smile, boy. Better wipe off that smile. We'll spit through the streets of the cities we wreck, and we'll find you a leader that you can't elect. Those treaties we signed were a pain in the neck. 'Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world.
The perfect bumper music for Empire, the great turning from Empire to Earth Community. Welcome back, my friends. 970 days, 10 hours, 25 minutes, 42 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, barring impeachment. But how many days until the end of the American empire? David Corton is with us. He's the author of When Corporations Rule the World and The Post-Corporate World and other books. And his most recent, or his newest book, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. David, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's great to be on the show with my favorite talk show host.
Well, thank you. You're too kind. Actually, you can hear me in Seattle, can't you?
Oh, I can, yeah. I download you on my iPod every day.
Oh, what a hoot. Well, great to have you here, David. This book is so sweeping, so broad in its reach. I mean, you're going right across the arc of civilization, from literally the originating stories of civilization up until today. And in the end, and I don't want to be telling your book. I mean, but we need to figure out here where we're going to go with this. You know, which part of it we want to talk about along the way. Some really shocking lessons. First of all, how did we get where we are?
Well, you know, this is an interesting thing. And, of course, in When Corporations Rule the World, I've got into the issues of corporate globalization, and it was right at the time when many of us were just kind of waking up to the issues of what these trade agreements were really about and how they're the unfolding of the corporate global economy is resulting in a consolidation of power and institutions that are solely about making money for rich people, mm-hmm. and often at the expense of ordinary people and nature. Now, what happened after 9/11 was George Bush and a lot of the policy analysts started talking explicitly about empire. That's interesting. That's a term that had become archaic.
It's a word that we really hadn't used in 100 years in any meaningful way.
Yeah, I mean, and I hardly use it. I think I made a reference to the evil empire in When Corporations Rule the World. So
and even then it was a Star Wars.
Yeah, it was Star Wars. Bounce, yeah, you know? Exactly. But the thing that happened is that this triggers when you start talking about empire and we're going to impose imperial order on the world by military force. Then it puts you in the context of 5,000 years of human history, going back to the original empires in Mesopotamia and the Nile River Valley. Now, you look at that in the context of how things are playing out in our own societies with we're seeing an unraveling of imperial institutions simply because we're reaching the limits of the domination and exploitation that the planet and society will sustain.
Now, what about Julian Simon's hypothesis that there are no limits ultimately, that it's always possible for us to figure out how to recycle more efficiently, basically that our intellect will save us?
Yeah, I think that's total nonsense. I mean, we see from the environmental indicators that we're trashing the planet. We're destroying the regenerative capacity, which is the foundation of all real wealth of the planet. And that's part of reaching the limits of empire. And of course, as we're seeing with the development of terrorism, the impossibility of using a conventional military force in Iraq to actually impose order on the insurgency, that with modern communications, weapons, and so forth, you just simply cannot maintain order with conventional military power. So these are all marks of the end of empire. Now,
I'm just curious. The British couldn't maintain order here with conventional military power in 1776.
That's true, even in those.
Yeah, is this a micro history repeats itself, or is this a macro history repeats itself? Is this something much bigger, or is this something that's new to history?
Well, that's a very good question. I kind of picked up there on Jonathan Schell's thesis that there is a shift, that it is far more difficult to impose imperial order than it once was. But I think the critical question is not whether this is totally new or not, but recognizing that we cannot impose order with those conventional military means. And we're going to be seeing an unraveling of these institutions that are devoted to maintaining the dominator hierarchy. Now, the thing I find fascinating about taking this back in history is to really understand the dynamics of empire. It helps us understand where we're at right now and the depth of the changes that have to take place as we as we move beyond these institutions that are essentially designed to concentrate the power, control over the wealth of the planet and society in the hands of a very few people, and move to very different partnership ways of organizing.
You sound like my old friend Rianne Eisler.
Yeah, this comes directly out of Rianne. You know,
yeah.
In fact, just before I started writing this, I was having a dinner with Rianne.
Indeed.
I was telling her, you know, I think your frame of the dominator versus partnership society is going to be the theme of my next book, but I haven't quite figured out how it comes together. And then summer after 9/11, Vandana Shiva was visiting from India, and we were talking about how the aftermath of 9/11 and the this shift in the ambience to where anybody that was engaged in any kind of questioning of the status quo was being branded a terrorist. Vandana was saying, you know, our whole analysis is based on the corporate globalization, and now we seem to be in a new ball game. We're back to classical empire, military domination, and so forth. Our analysis doesn't embrace that.
Now,
and that was the origin. So, yeah, we've got to understand that. We've got to have a new framework.
The Romans arguably created empire, extended empire, as a result of an energy crisis. They had defoliated or deforested Italy. And so completely, in fact, that the price of the wood used to smelt silver became more expensive than the silver that was smelted, producing this huge currency crisis that they had about, 120 BC or thereabouts, as I recall. And that led them to build their initial fleet of 56 wooden ships that they then expanded out, and that was the beginning of the British Empire, you know, and it ultimately led to Caesar, you know, charging up into England and whatnot. To what extent is our empire being driven by our needs for energy, and to what extent can we save ourselves from that? Can we pull back from that, or have we already gone beyond the point where we can't make the decision not to be empire?
Well,
at least if we want to survive as, you know, with life as we know it.
Well, I think very clearly that to maintain the extremely wasteful lifestyles that that we pursue, and it's a lot of it's not luxuries, it's just, you know, wasteful transportation and the kind of morass that we have.
Well, we're using technology that was developed when oil was considered to be an unlimited resource.
Yeah. And, you know, it simply requires more and more, a larger percentage of the planet's resources to maintain the status quo in the United States. So, you know, I think there's a very direct parallel that you note there. But the question is, as we are running up against these limits, it becomes increasingly unsustainable. Now, you know, this is also reflected in our rapidly growing trade deficit that, you know, last year got up to $750 billion and growing. Now, that gap is a measure of the extent to which we are living beyond our own means, paying for the difference with foreign credit and leaving the bill to our children. Now, eventually, the rest of the world's going to wake up to the fact that they're shipping off their resources, the products of their labor, and so forth, to an economic deadbeat who really has no means to, or intention of ever repaying. And, you know, that's when that house of cards starts to fall down.
Right. There are a lot of people who are speculating, and your background is as an economist.
Well, actually, I write a lot about economics, so people get confused about that.
Okay.
But actually, my field is organization and psychology, and so I look at economies as behavioral systems rather than simply price systems, and that brings in the institutions and all the elements that that sort of mainstream.
But you work with the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank?
Well, I work with the World Bank. I work with the USAID, Ford Foundation, taught at the Harvard Business School.
And so I'm curious, economically, at what point do the rest of the countries of the world say it looks like America isn't going to repay us? There's been a lot of speculation that in March, I think it was March 26th, the Bush administration stopped publishing M3, which a number that has been available since literally the founding of the Fed in 1913, I think it was. And M3 is the number that expresses the ratio between the amount of money that we're printing or creating and the amount of money that should be there as a function of the natural growth of the economy, you know, reflecting goods and services versus money. In other words, it's the measure of whether or not we're inflating our currency the way that the Germans did in the 20s. Now, the Germans inflated their currency in the 20s in order to be able to pay back the debts of the Treaty of Versailles so that, you know, they had debts that were in today's dollars, maybe $1 trillion or hundreds of billions, certainly. And they said, we can't afford to pay this back. So what we'll do, since the debts were denominated in Deutschmarks and they had control over the value of the currency, they said, what we'll do is we'll make the currency worth less. And so we can pay it off with, you know, and so you reached a point where it cost $1 billion to buy a loaf of bread, but that meant that they could pay off their entire debt to England in a week. A lot of people speculating that the Bush administration is up to the same trick. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, I don't have any inside information on that, but I certainly wouldn't put it past them. I mean, clearly the financial system, the horrendous debts that the administration is building up, both in terms of our public debt, but also our international debt, cannot be sustained. So I suspect that there is a connection.
We have to do something about it quick. We're talking with David Corton, his new book, The Great Turning. David, stick around. I have a couple more questions for you. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just a quick tip, or an FYI, or whatever you call it. I'll be doing the Randy Rhodes program on Air America Radio this afternoon. And on June 12th through the 14th, the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, their website, Campaign for America's Future is putting on the Take Back America 2006 conference. And I will be broadcasting live from there on Monday and Tuesday, which I believe is the 12th and 13th. And it's going to be an amazing event. A lot going on, a lot of great people there. We will be broadcasting the program live from there, so we'll be having an unending stream of guests. The right has had its way and failed, they say. The war in Iraq has made us less secure. Tax cuts starve vital investment. Economic and trade policies driven wages down. And we're paying the cost of Republicans' systemic corruption. And boy, are we. Speaking of the cost, we're talking with David Corton. David C. Corton, the author, his newest book, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. David, let's try and bring this down to practical stuff. What do we do? You talk about changing our stories. What do we do? And what are the stories that are alternatives?
Yeah, part of understanding our current political situation is understanding the extent to which the far right has been able to take over our politics by defining the stories by which we understand ourselves, where we're at, and actually in creation, and what our possibilities are. And it starts, for example, with our national story, you know, that we are a democracy. We have the most democratic institutions and the ideal. Now, what that does is if we assume that we've already arrived, then we don't question our existing institutions. We don't look for ways to deepen democracy in our country.
And the fact of the matter is that we really started more as an oligarchy and have been for a long, long time,
exactly.
And that there are other countries in the world that are actually much more democratic.
Yeah, I refer to it as plutocracy, which means ruled by the wealthy.
Right.
Now, there are also the stories about our human nature, that we are just inherently greedy and violent, and therefore, you know, any talk of organizing a society on a more cooperative, collaborative basis is just totally unrealistic. You know, the most immediate, and of course in the areas of economics and politics, they define the stories by what, you know, how we understand how we achieve prosperity, security, and meaning. The economic story, the prosperity story, is that you know, progress, prosperity is measured by economic growth. To have economic growth, you have to have investment. To have investment, you have to have wealthy people. So therefore, you have to take off the regulations, eliminate taxes on wealthy people, so they can accumulate fortunes and invest. The security story is the world's full of terrorists and criminals and evil enemies, and we have to control them with police and military. Now, you begin, you know, once you articulate these stories, of course, we know we hear them over and over and over again, totally repeated. But they're always legitimating the rule by a wealthy elite and control by coercive force. Now, if we begin to reframe the stories and recognize, you know, we were started as a democratic experiment, but it was very partial. We still have a long ways to go. Understand that our human nature is actually, what defines our human nature is our capacity to choose, and we have many, many possibilities. Obviously, violence and greed are part of it, but we also have the possibilities if we mature more in our consciousness and our sense of our moral character. We have the possibility to be extremely cooperative, to be concerned about the interests of the whole of society and our fellow human beings and nature. And you see this in the mature elders, this kind of quality of mind that opens up possibilities for very different kinds of democracy and economics. Of course, you come to prosperity and you begin to dig a little deeper and you realize, you know, prosperity is not measured by the amount of money that we make or churn around. Real prosperity is measured by the health of our children, our families, our communities, the health of our democracy, and the health of the environment. Mm-hmm. You begin to redefine the stories. You come to realize that the real foundations of prosperity and security actually are community. And I'm really struck when you get
into now we're back to tribal roots.
I mean, well, it's partly
we're back to the way, you know, humans for thousands of years by trial and error, they worked this out in what we call Aboriginal and Indigenous societies.
Yeah, and it's still, and there's a deep hunger. I was so struck after 9/11 that you get into any kind of conversation, what people wanted was community. Now, you know, George rallied us around war, but, you know, what people were really looking for was, you know, how do we stick together and create a society that's stronger and healthier, able to live in a more cooperative relationship with the world.
How do we?
Well, partly we start by changing the stories. I mean, it is so simple when you get down to it. As long as we are, you know, we define ourselves by the manufactured stories of the far right, then they control the debate.
So what are we have about 40 seconds here. What are the alternative stories?
Yeah. The alternative, we're creatures of many natures. The democratic story that we were started as an experiment, but it's an unfinished project. That true prosperity, security, and meaning are all found in community, and we need to be looking for ways to rebuild our local economies, restructure our politics, and so forth, so that they're based on the premise of cooperation, working for the well-being of whole, and working particularly, putting as our measure of progress the well-being of our children, the strength of our families, the strength of community, and the health of our natural systems.
Well said. David Corton, his new book, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. It's out now.
It is out.
And
davidcorton.org,
the website. Thank you, Dave. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Congressman Bernie Sanders, longest-serving independent in the House of Representatives, will be with us. Brunch with Bernie, taking your calls. Conservative David Tebow thinks the tax break will offset gas prices. I'll let him know he's missing the mark by a long shot. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where you're in the Democracy Zone. Remember, my friends, democracy begins.